From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Noel Mehring, author of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. Let's now join Hank and Noel Mehring in their conversation.
It's one thing to be manipulated ourselves, right? And the movement has been manipulating us for a long time. It's another thing when you see it directed at your kids. And a lot of times people who have been manipulated or abused or what have you, and I think there's a real analogy you can draw between, you know, an abusive person to what the woke movement does, that sort of manipulation. Oftentimes what pulls them out of it is seeing it targeted at their child. So I think, you know, insofar as parents' movement is going to rise up, if it's not now, I'm a little doubtful what will bring it on. Because if we do not resist it now, then there's no lie that they cannot convince us of, right?
I mean, these kids are becoming generational lab rats. I mean, I see some of the images, Noel, you know, an arm completely butchered so that you can build a penis, or chopping off breasts at an early age, surgical savageries that are unimaginable being talked about in very conversational terms, as you say, you know, with the accommodating music in the background.
Right. And I mean, my hope is may the lawsuits and maybe arrests rain down at some point. You know, we're already seeing in England, there's a whole host of, I think, 1,000 lawsuits against this gender clinic targeting minors that had to close down. There's, I think, 1,000 families bringing lawsuits to that gender clinic. So maybe we start talking about that more, then that'll cast some fear into the people who are promulgating this. But you're right, they are lab rats. It's deeply confusing for children. And where are the grownups in the room? You know, that's one of the things that drives me crazy. And I talk about in the book, you know, Hannah Arendt talked about when she went to one of the main propagandists for Nazi Germany, his trial, the Nuremberg trials, she was struck by how banal he seemed. She thought she was going to see someone who's the personification of evil. But rather, he just was sort of not able to think deeply. He just had numbed himself from thinking deeply. And I think slogans do that to us. You know, the movement is really uses a lot of sloganeering. Sloganeering is sort of the death of deep thought. But also the idea that selling us on small lies, here's a lie, here's a greater lie, here's another lie, here's an even bigger lie, that evolution of accepting another lie on top of another lie eventually makes people who can't think. And that's how she described him. He was characterized by the curious inability to think. And I think a lot, that's what I hear from a lot of parents who, you know, I'll chat with progressive parents who, they're kind of confused by this. They're kind of uncomfortable with it. They hope their kids don't change genders, but they see their kids' friends changing genders. And they think, well, you know, what are you going to do? They might kill themselves. They might be suicidal if we say no. We have to just accept them. And I just think you've lost your ability to think and then have the courage to speak what you know to be true. You know, and that's what's so sad to me is that they're oftentimes well-meaning people, you know, good, decent people. But that's how the movement succeeds, right? It's by convincing, you know, people who are just decent, moral people that compassion and love means something that it doesn't mean.
Gut level, do you think that there's a real opportunity for us to move away from the ledge? You write in the book about how things progress, first generation, the kinds of things we're talking about right now, we couldn't even talk about. The second generation becomes normalized. And then the third generation, you have the collapse of civilization. It happened with the Roman Empire. It has happened with civilization after civilization after civilization. Can we move away from that ledge?
I'm an optimist by nature, and I have, obviously, as all Christians do, understand that we have a God of miracles and a God who creates opportunity to defeat evil where we thought there was none. David and Goliath, you know, that there's all the reason in the world to have hope. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to have perfect success in this world. Our hope and our victory can look like our persecution, you know, and certainly that we can be on the cusp of a massive age of persecution of Christians and families. So on a gut level, I really don't feel, I could see it going either way, but I know either way it goes, whether or not we're entering, you know, decades of times of suffering and persecution, or whether or not that there's going to be a cultural renaissance and we're going to reject all of this. either way, I guess I just trust him and feel that we will be triumphant either way.
So, Noelle,
that's an unsatisfying answer. I know.
Yeah, I get it. But I was just in India, and I was thinking as you were talking about being in the midst of literally hundreds of thousands of first-generation Christians, and they're fervent in their faith. And oftentimes I come back to the West and I find that the Christian church is fossilized. They're not even in the game.
Yeah. I think that we're seeing so much of the future of the church in those other nations because we become such a decadent society. It's extraordinarily difficult to develop moral courage and a strong Christian witness when we are really soft and have an easy life and are not training ourselves sort of to make those small sacrifices habitually that sort of keep us in denial of that kind of easing into a soft, comfortable life. So, you know, there's so much of Renaissance happening with people leaving public schools, people moving towards homeschooling, you know, little communities springing up to strengthen each other and to, you know, create some sort of mini Renaissance where they live. So if it's going to happen in the West, it has to be through things like that, I think, because I don't think that we get there continuing to live a comfortable, soft life that we've been living. I think that we have to realize that this is something that is a spiritual battle ultimately and be fighting at that level. And that starts with strengthening ourselves, right? It starts with ourselves.
There's a shocking statement in your book that bears elaboration. I don't know if this is you or you're quoting someone else, I can't remember, but this is the quote, "If the first duty of parenthood, which is allowing the child to live, has been eliminated, we can be sure every other human duty will be eliminated as well."
Yeah, it's the most fundamental right is the right to live, right? But the idea that it's the decision is being made by a person's own parents, particularly the mother-child bond, is so fundamentally destructive that it seems like that we're eradicating the whole foundation of not only our rights, but our understanding that we have duties to one another. And I think that abortion is so symbolic. It's the reason why the women's movement will never let go of the pro-abortion stance. You know, there's a lot of, I think, you know, there's pro-life feminists who say, oh, we can march alongside each other. This is not going to change. They are not going to change unless they are converted, right? Abortion is, you know, the ultimate recognition that not only can your body not limit you, but your own offspring cannot limit you to the point of them having to sacrifice their own life. It's that prowling after innocence made very tangible, right, is in abortion, that my will has to triumph over everything, over any duty. And the woman's body is fashioned to speak to something anthropologically really deep about the human person, that we are not made to march through this world exerting our will left and right. We are made to be connected to one another, that we are familial by nature in our very creation and our very design. And that implies that we are made to serve one another, that we, you know, my friend Carter Sneed writes beautifully about this. So we come into the world not as an independent, autonomous being, but rather as a baby, utterly dependent, with no ability to care for himself at all. But there, and that speaks to some inherent, you know, demands of the parents, duties, and says, you know, that your life is not your own either. Even though you are independent, can care for yourself, now is your opportunity to care for someone else, to serve someone else. It's fundamentally an anthropology based on service, which is, as Christians, we know that that's where the rubber meets the road, is how do we serve? And where the devil denied Christ is when he said, I will not serve. Whether or not we were willing to serve is the crux of the matter. And I think abortion is a real encapsulation of that divide.
You're right that in woke ideology, the distinction between the sexes has to be denied, while the distinction between the races has to be exaggerated.
Yeah, no, this is really interesting. I mean, we have transgender, but we don't have trans race, right? There was a woman who grew up and she pretended to be African-American. It was in the news maybe like 5 or 10 years ago. She became a president of a chapter of NAACP. She really felt like that was her culture. She had grown up with persons of color and really loved that. It wasn't anything that she was making fun of. She just really understood herself to be transracial. But that is not allowed. And I think it's interesting to think about why. And the reason I talk about in the book is that for the sexes, if insofar as you eradicate differences between men and women, you really disrupt the possibility for harmony between them, because that sexual difference implies a difference in conduct. You know, I can't behave with male friends the way that I might with my female friends. You know, there's just a propriety there as a married woman. But even in college, so for example, there are desegregating dorms by sex, where boys and girls would share a bathroom. And this really creates a lot of, well, for one, there's an opportunity for abuse there. There's an opportunity for impropriety that leads to behaviors that are destructive for both. And there's a rejection of a certain reverence that I think is really beautiful that men can have for women, in that in seeing that they are more vulnerable biologically and physically, you know, the beauty that that implies, it demands something of the man that helps him actually become a good man.
Stay right there, because we'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noelle Mehring. The long-simmering crisis that grips our culture has exploded in recent years, leaving us divided and intransigent. Discourse seems futile when we are no longer a people with shared principles or even a shared understanding of reality. What seems obvious to one person is patently absurd to the next. The collapse of meaning is not accidental. It has been plotted and documented for decades and now presents in its current form as woke ideology. Awake, Not Woke by Noelle Mehring unmasked this ideology by examining its history, major players, premises, and tactics, showing us that wokeness is at its core an ideology of rupture. Indeed, it is an ideology with fundamentalist and cult-like characteristics that is on a collision course with Christianity. To receive your copy of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.
For decades, Hank Hanegraaff has shared the truth of the historic Christian faith by answering questions over the radio, defending the faith through the written word, and preaching from pulpits around the globe. Today, he is ready to share his life in Christ, as detailed in his most profoundly personal piece of penmanship to date, Truth Matters, Life Matters More. Hank feels closer to Christ than ever before and wants you to learn from his experiences as recounted in Truth Matters, Life Matters More, so that you can join him on life's greatest journey, the journey toward union with God in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, The Unexpected Beauty of an Authentic Christian Life, call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org.
or call 888-7000-CRI. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Noel Mehring, as they continue their conversation.
But even in college, so for example, they are desegregating dorms by sex. And this really creates a lot of, well, one, there's an opportunity for abuse there. There's an opportunity for impropriety that leads to behaviors that are destructive for both. And there's a rejection of a certain reverence that I think is really beautiful that men can have for women. So you eradicate those differences, you create a whole host of chaos between men and women. Meanwhile, for the races, you reify the differences. You don't eradicate them, you exaggerate them. Why? Because there's no real code of conduct that required that differentiates the races. I don't need to behave differently with a Black female friend than I do with a white female friend, and vice versa, and same with men. The racial difference does not imply social difference. But in both avenues, the woke movement chooses the pathway to more division, to more chaos, and to also that's least likely to lead to friendship.
I want you to address the issue of Black Lives Matter. You do in the book, and I was just in Seattle, and I needed the assistance of the police for a particular issue that I was dealing with there. And I remember I had a hotel right in the center of Seattle. I could walk, I think it was 0.5 mile, and be at the main headquarters of the police department there. And I got there, and there was a sign on the door saying that they were closed. And they would be closed for a certain amount of time because they didn't have enough staff. So here the main office, the central office in Seattle of the police department, closed. And I was told by people there, now this is a bit anecdotal, but I was told by people that really are in the know that this was a matter of Black Lives Matter closing down the Seattle Police Department. So again, it's anecdotal, but the point you make about Black Lives Matter is they seek to disrupt the nuclear family, and I've seen that on their website. They're queer-affirming. They seek to free civilization from the grip of heteronormative thinking, and the founders and organizers proudly proclaim that they are trained Marxists.
Yeah, I mean, what I think most, it's understandable why so many police officers have fled the vocation, right? They have so, you know, the idea that for even taking the phrase, all cops are bastards, that's something that was ubiquitous, you know, in 2020, there's, you know, in the marches, all cops are bastards. I mean, if that's not putting the group over the person, I don't know what is. And so if you're going to demonize, you know, every individual that's part of a job that is for the sake of the law and order of civilized society, well, who's going to want to do that job? And they were aided and abetted by the most powerful people in the country. You know, there are hosts of politicians, you know, encouraging the rioting, encouraging the demonization of policemen. It's very difficult to maintain that position in that environment, in that climate. I don't necessarily fault people who said, you know, I'm going to retire early. And in fact, I know officers who did. But that's part of the movement too, that movement towards chaos. There really is an effort to break down law and order in society. And that helps revolution. It's not a hindrance. And I think we saw in 2020 in particular, that there were a bunch of people let out of prisons because of COVID policies. And I remember, and I'm outside of Los Angeles, thinking this is insane. What are we doing? What does this have to do with COVID? But if you read, you know, Foucault, you read some of these postmodernists, and they want to deinstitutionalize people and to break down order in society. So yeah, I mean, the violence is on the uptick. We talk a lot about how people have fled urban areas. And oftentimes people say, well, just because we can work remotely now. Okay. But that's also a lot of denial about this whole other reason why people are fleeing from urban areas. And it's the breakdown of safety and order.
A profound statement in your book, you say wokeism has a supply and demand problem. The demand to uncover racism is an all-time high, while the supply of racial transgression is an all-time low. Now, that's an arresting statement in itself.
Yeah, no, I think that if you find your moral stature to be built around your ability to identify as a victim, that's going to mean that you have to also have a constant stream of perpetrators. So we have to become built as we begin to identify as accusers. And I talked about that. I don't know if I talked about that in the book, but you know, I really think there is, that's another layer of the spiritual war happening, is that your identity is to become an accuser, whereas the Christian identity is to be self-accusing, right? Through my fault, mea culpa, self-examining, identifying, understanding that you're a sinner. The movement really gives you an incentive to not to identify in that way, but to identify the sins of others in order to maintain your status. And so that's where I think part of the reason where microaggressions come from, that if we become far less racist country, I think that's pretty undeniable. That doesn't mean we're perfect. And that is, I'm not denying that racism is real and that it exists and that it happens and it's extremely unjust and evil. But it belies, you know, common sense and the understanding of history to think that we haven't improved greatly. So as those opportunities to identify perpetrators have gone down, we have at the same time increased intensely our desire to find perpetrators. And so that's where I think, in part, microaggressions come from, that if we can't point to explicit actions that people are doing that are racially transgressive, we have to find kind of subtle ways. So, you know, when people say, I strive to be colorblind, that's considered a microaggression now, because colorblind is the old way. That's kind of more the Martin Luther King Jr. way, that we seek to judge people by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. We've left that behind. Now, you know, to say that is to deny that you're seeing, you know, that person's blackness. And so you're in some ways, it's a white perspective that is projecting sort of a dominance into the conversation. That's one example, but there's a whole host of microaggressions that people can point out.
Yeah, what's really interesting, and you underscore this beautifully in the book, uses an example, Ibram Kendi, who you mentioned earlier on in the conversation, who says that the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. So discrimination is actually now sanitized. If the discrimination comes from the right sources, it's okay. So you can say things like white skin is subhuman, or that white people are a genetic defect of blackness. This is intentional.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the goodness, moral goodness of the act is not determined by the act itself, but by the person committing the act. So if you are on the right side of the oppression line, then you can behave in certain ways that the other side could not. And that even, it gets at sort of that innocence thing we were talking about earlier, that there's a blamelessness that can be assigned to the correct identity group if it is in service of the ideology. And I think, yeah, that Ibram Kendi's quote points directly to that. There's no problem with racial discrimination, according to the movement. It just has to be directed in the right way.
Yeah. You say that critical theory replaces the free exchange of ideas, and you mentioned this earlier on in the podcast, with party cliches, propaganda, and sloganeering. And so the faculties of critical thinking have become dulled.
Yeah. And I think that's one way in which you see it mimics kind of cult behavior. You know, you think of people in cults, they probably wouldn't call it sloganeering, but there'll be certain mantras that they might repeat to kind of keep them from maybe acknowledging something that's wrong and that's going on, or to convince them of the truth of the power of this cult. But I think sloganeering is effective in that way, right? That it gives us a place to hang our hat without having to think more deeply. We see this with, you know, love wins, you know, the slogan to support LGBTQ pride, love wins. Well, that's, you know, such a land grab to say that this is the side of love, and that, you know, the people who, you know, are supporting traditional marriage are on the side of something that's not love, which actually is hate, you know, that. But that slogan, I think the more you repeat that, then the more people just say, well, you know, I don't want to think more deeply about this. I don't want to be shamed. And there's a lot of manipulation that's happening there, right? You don't want to be on the wrong side. You don't want to appear to be unloving. Maybe there's an angry mob that you could potentially see coming after you. Maybe you might lose your job. Maybe you'll be considered impolite. You'll be seen as being judgmental and therefore held to a higher standard. And so you know your own sins, you have your own shame, and you don't want that to be a focus. And so you think, well, if I can just, you know, have this shortcut to virtue. There's a whole host of psychological things that I think are happening in that sloganeering process, but they're effective because oftentimes it's harder to look at the truth. It's harder to look at the truth about ourselves, to look at the truth about the matter at hand when it's controversial. Truth takes effort and work and discipline. And sloganeering takes little effort.
Yeah, I love the way you said that's a land grab. I was thinking, as you said that, about a particular slogan communicated by a mega church in America, gay or straight here, there's no hate here. That's a land grab.
Yeah, because in other words, everywhere else there's hate, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there's a concept that you address in the book. It's called idea laundering. And I think that's really important to unpack, idea laundering, because you have these obtuse, ridiculous ideas that become laundered such that they've gone through repetition in venues for so long that they become peer-reviewed, and then they have an authenticity that really doesn't belong to the essence of the argument.
Yeah, so the phrase I referenced in the book, I did not come up with that phrase, but it's a real thing that happens in academia, that you can kind of come up with a proposition, or you have a certain belief that you want to have reinforced and have the veneer of, you know, the academy behind it. And then you pitch a journal article out there to like-minded institutions that might, you know, gets accepted and published, then it becomes something that can be cited, right? It can be cited by like-minded people, a certain amount of citations. All of a sudden, you know, you have something that kind of has this gravitas of the academy standing behind it.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we will continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noel Mehring. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology by Noel Mehring. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. Again, that's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org, equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org.